Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started. Hello, everybody. My name is Jordan, and today I am going to be joined by Joanna Grace from Sensory Projects. Hello, Joanna.
Thanks for having me.
I think I last saw you in 2010, maybe 2011.
Wow. Oh, gosh, that feels old, isn't it?
It was in London, and you were doing a touring show with Flo Longhorn about sensory stories.
Yes. Yeah, Flo's forums. Yeah, they were ace.
Yeah, fantastic. And do you know what? I was so blown away. I mean, just blown away by the two of you anyway. But actually, it was when, and I've always remembered this, and I always use this for when I'm thinking about making stories and creating stories, which I do a lot. You had one about a tattoo, and you used a tattoo gun.
With your people.
And I just loved that, because before that, I'd always used baby stories and fluffy, soft things and nursery rhymes. And that's fine for some. For me, as a new teacher, as a new SEN teacher, was a light bulb moment. Like, well, yeah, duh. Of course you can do that. So thank you for that.
It was one, I was trying to get an adult care audience interested in sharing sensory stories with the people they support. And if you sort of go in to adult care and say, you can tell them stories, they're like, yeah, it's a bit babyish. And I was trying to think, how can I make a sensory connection to the staff who support in adult care? And tattoo guns is a really good way of doing it, because a lot of people have tattoos and they're like, yeah, that was a sensory experience. Yeah. I'm there. And my friendly tattooist adapted that gun, has tattooed me, and he adapted the gun so that I can use it with a, I think I can put a biro in it or something like that, so I can write on your skin, but all the, apart from the piercing your skin with the needle aspect, the bug and the, all of that is the real sensation. It's a good one. I like the tattoo sensory story. Pete Wells has got we're going on a pub crawl as a sensory story.
But why not?
You don't have to go on a bear hunt every year for life. Not compulsory.
You absolutely don't. And then that brings me on to your beautiful story, sensory stories as well, that you have created, that again are so accessible for all. They're finally not infantasizing actually at all, and that's why I love them.
It was always one of my worries when I was sharing stories with people who carry, in the UK they carry the label for animals for learning disabilities. You don't know how much somebody's understanding, and I would hate to be patronizing you if you are understanding, but also I would hate to be offering you something that you can't connect with unless you have an understanding. And if you start at a sensory level and work up from there, I hope that you can genuinely include everybody. So lots of stories, like the way pantomimes are written for the children and the adults. There's a story called Puddle, which is about somebody who dives into a puddle and then has an adventure at sea. And at the end of that story, there's a woman waiting on the pavement for you. And if you're a child reading that story, that's your mum waiting on the pavement. But if you're a teenager, it could be your girlfriend, or it could be a love interest. But there are different ways of accessing the stories. I hope that they're good for everybody. But my stories all have a particular tone. I'm interested in factual narratives, so I've got like science-based ones or history-based ones, and then other sensory story authors. So like I mentioned Pete Wells's stories have a very particular tone, much more anarchic than mine. And Vicky Navin writes in rhyming couplets, which I don't know how she does. But yeah, there's lots of different ones out there now. If you met me, 14 years ago. Yeah, so originally there was just 5 stories on the Sensory Projects, and we're over 30 now.
Amazing. So what do you feel makes a good sensory story?
Two things. The most important thing is the sensory invitation. Because I see a lot of stories where people have just gathered things from around the room, like a cuddly toy, a water spray bottle. And obviously being sprayed with water is an interesting sensory experience, but it gets done a lot. So I don't know how interesting it is if it's something that happens to you on a daily basis. You're like, if you attend a mainstream school, you can go through your whole school career without a teacher squirting you in the face with water. But if you go to a special school, it happens all the time. So you want something that's really, really good sensory. And so I always imagine, I don't know if you can do this, if you imagine like your brain and your senses as little characters, if you took the brain away and just left the eyes, would the eyes be interested in looking at this thing? Mm-hmm. You know, if the reason that you're looking at it is because you're curious or because you know that's the main character of the story, if it's coming from an intellectual start point, then I haven't got complete sensory. So I want something that draws the attention of a sensory system alone. Mm-hmm. Or fills a whole sensory system. So quite often I'm holding up coloured sheets of cellophane, because when you look through cellophane, everything that you see changes. So it's a massive visual experience. You don't need to understand it. So you want really good sensory, and then you want concise text.
Okay.
So the rule of thumb is 8-10 sentences for a sensory story. So quite often people adapt children's books, yeah, like you were saying. But actually there's a lot of text in your average children's book. So that it's like a kind of haiku art form to convey a story in just a few sentences.
Yeah,
and you put together, those are my two good ingredients to a really great
sentence. I love that. That is actually something I am, both of those things are things that I am incredibly guilty of, actually. And you saying that makes so much sense, because it has to, so often we forget about the sense of smell, or like we're doing sounds and visual or textures, but what about the sense of smell?
So there's two things there. So the concise text, the stuff that I say, it's not coming out of nowhere. So I'm pulling from bits of different research. Mm. The concise text stuff, there's loads of research that shows that we all take in more information when less is said. It's why our politicians speak in sound bites. We understand more when people say less. And then there's a whole load of research done on teachers where they go, teachers talk too much. They just talk too much. So the concise text has value for people who have full intellectual capacity, but also if you're somebody who has very little intellectual capacity, for whom the sensory aspect is going to be more valuable, text that comes before the sensory aspect is the thing that tells you something's going to happen. Yeah. Like you hear a particular set of noises and then somebody offers you a smell. If I just offered you the smell, you don't have chance to orientate your sensory systems to that. Mm-hmm. And actually I work with people who that orientation of their senses is a thing that they have to properly do. Like obviously we're all doing it all the time, but like I know somebody who can see and they can hear and they can feel, but they can't do them all at once.
Yes, okay.
And so if they know, if I make a noise that is my sentence, and that noise lets them know that what's going to be happening next is something that they're going to be looking at, they have chance to kind of go, okay, I need to get my eyes up and ready, and then they get more out of it. So the concise text is really powerful for the people who maybe aren't understanding it at all, and it's really powerful for the people who are understanding. And then you mentioned smell, which is like a smells. I generally run to 7 senses on the sensory projects. Although once you start dealing in subconscious senses, it is like gateway drugs, and you end up sliding into more. So I'm up to 9 now, but I try and keep it to 7. But smell is a really unusual one, because it's the only sensory system processed by the limbic brain, which is your feeling brain.
Okay.
All your other senses are processed by your thalamus, which is your thinking brain. And so you can feel it in the way that you think about things. Like if you think about like a famous painting, like Edvard Munch's The Scream, or Van Gogh's Starry Night, or Jerry Halliwell's Union Jack. Yes, you can see it in your... It's not like you're hallucinating it, but you can see it in your mind's eye. Yeah. You can get stuck in your head. Like you can think songs. If I was to hum a few bars of Baby Shark, then everybody
done
having Baby Shark. But you can't think smell.
No.
You feel. And so when you ask people to smell, you're asking the emotional labor of them. Mm. And it's a big ask. So you want to go really cautiously on it.
And it's so true, isn't it? Because it can be really emotive, smell. Sometimes you won't have had a food for ages and you've forgotten about it, and actually you'll have it and all of a sudden it'll take you straight back to nursery or take you straight back to your grandma's house or whatever it is. People keep jumpers and cushions from loved ones that have passed, don't they? And I feel like it's incredibly emotive and sentimental, actually, is that sense of smell, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes if you're working with people who are already stressed or who are overwhelmed by stuff, then adding smells into that is a big ask.
Yeah.
You go really cautiously yourself. I'd go like one smell in an hour, and I'd be, if I was brave enough, I'd be asking staff who wear strong perfumes to wash them off, but I'm not brave enough.
Well, actually, no, I have had that. I have had students that haven't wanted to work with certain teaching assistants, and when it quite came down to it, it was because of their perfume.
Yeah. A lot.
A few times, yeah. So you mentioned seven. I think most people are saying, but there's five senses.
There's the famous, famous five conscious senses. And actually hidden in those are a lot of the subconscious. So like we have a sense of temperature and a tactile sense, and we cluster them all together as touch. But it's possible to be able to feel texture, but not be able to understand temperature, or it's possible to be able to feel temperature and not understand texture. So it's a bit like deciding how many constellations there are in the sky. It just depends how we group these neurons. But there are 33 sets of neurons that control your senses. So arguably you've got 33 sensory systems, but that would get a bit much, because in a sensory story you only get 8 to 10 sentences. So seven is manageable. 8, 9 is getting a bit too ambitious, really. But my seven, I do the famous five. And then quite like often you're working with somebody who is missing one of the sensory systems or can't eat, and you lose a few, so it's worth having a couple of backups. I use proprioception, which is your awareness of where your body is in space. And it's a weird one to think about, but most people have had an experience of not having proprioception just as they're waking up or falling asleep, and they get that sensation of falling. Do you ever have that?
Yes.
Where you go, and what's happening is your proprioceptive sense is falling asleep slightly before you or waking up slightly after you, and you just have a moment where you don't have an awareness of where your body is in space.
Right.
It's a really unnerving thing, and people can have differences to their proprioception in the same way they can have differences to vision or differences to hearing. And so if you don't have full proprioceptive capacity, and I'm actually somebody who doesn't, you don't fully have an awareness of where your body is all the time. And that's slightly unnerving.
Yeah.
So stimulation that tells somebody where their body is a really good way of supporting the proprioceptive sense. So things like compression wear clothing and the weighted blankets and all of those things that are so popular in the sensory market, that's what they're doing. They're giving you information about where your body is. Brushing, massage, all of those things. Vibration is a great one, ways of offering proprioception. And then my other one I do is your vestibular sense, which is your sense of motion and balance. So if you can incorporate a movement in your sensory story, and it has to be a movement that involves the head, because the receptors to your vestibular sense are in your inner ear. So it's no good just waving your hand, that wouldn't do it. But anything that creates like an up, a down, or around, would offer stimulation to your vestibular sense and be another way.
Children in chairs, would you spin, rock, shake? You know, if they can do that, I mean, is that what it looks like?
Yeah. And actually, so your senses are a part receptor organ, part your brain understanding the information from the receptor organ. So the only time we really give that any credit in kind of day-to-day life is when we give babies black and white picture books, because we recognize this is a baby that can see, but they're not seeing in the same way that I'm seeing. And what's happening is it's partly, you know, the receptor organs picking up the information and partly your brain making sense of it. And it's about 25% pickup, 75% make sense of it. And so I have a friend who is blind, but her eyes work perfectly.
Right.
But her brain can't understand it. And a lot of the people that I work with maybe have the receptor capacity, but it's taking them longer to put together this information. And so I often talk about there being a curriculum of the senses. And I have a course called Develop Your Sensory Lexiconry, which is me teaching that curriculum of the senses. But there are things that it is easier for your senses to do and things that it is harder for them to do. So like the black and white picture books for sight, that makes sense, doesn't it? You pop out, you're getting all this visual information. It's easier to figure out that's black and that's white than it is to figure out that's peach and that's lemon yellow. Mm-hmm. Like sequence of things that you're learning. And with regards to your vestibular sense, that sense of motion and balance, the early way we learn about that sense is through bold directional movement. So you think of what we do with little babies. We rock them side to side, push them forwards and backwards in their buggy, and then we pass them to their daddy and they lob them into the air. Like, it's bold directional movement. And if you're somebody who requires supportive equipment, like if you're in a funky wheelchair, you probably spent your early years maybe in a bed, maybe you were in intensive care, you won't have had as much chance to have those bold directional movements. So you won't have had the opportunity to make sense of that stimulation, and you might not be processing it fully yet. And so by giving you those opportunities to access that movement, you can give an opportunity to help somebody understand the messages coming from their senses, and then that gives you more access to the work. Those two, I'm quite often eavesdropper on conversations where people go, would you prefer to be deaf or would you prefer to be blind? I think like there's a hierarchy. And actually, if you interjected in those conversations and said, would you prefer to be blind or would you prefer to lose your vestibular sense, most people would go, oh, my vestibular sense, I didn't know I had it. But both of those senses, your proprioception and your vestibulation, are fundamental to your capacity to move. And if you lose either one, it's total paralysis. And yeah. So offering stimulation to support movement and coordination and all of those things.
And those two are definitely being missed in sensory stories, because from my experience of sensory stories, looking around and working with lots of other people, often it's texture, it's smells, it's tastes even sometimes, but they're all quite passive. They're still and sitting. They do lots of other activities that are moving, but I feel like maybe often it gets forgotten when it's a story. Yeah. Maybe something in our brain says, sit down for story time. It's still and it's listening and it's passive. And actually, that's not the case. And it makes so much sense from what you're saying that, of course, that's not the case.
That tattoo sensory story that you were talking about at the beginning has a repeating line for it. I think I'm trying to remember it now. There's no one else who moves like me. It's just the way I roll. And when I'm telling it in a group, we sort of go around and do the story bit, and then that there's no one else who moves like me, it's just the way I roll. If people are being pushed in their chairs, we all sort of wheel around in a circle and spin, and if people can move themselves, it's like a chance for a little boogie in the middle of the story. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a great one, especially in the middle of the story, because that's when you need it.
Yeah. So my book Sensory Being for Sensory Beings would be that development of the senses. It's not a taught curriculum thing. It's just that's my way of thinking about it as a teacher, as I tend to think of them, because it's got that progressive sort of step-by-step aspect to it. It automatically gets called
the curriculum. I have a link to that and your textbook and your a couple of your other books as well. So what we'll do is your YouTube is so
yeah, if people are on YouTube, I've put up a load of free content recently. So you know, in when lockdown happened and everything went online and things like that, I ran some conferences that were focused on supporting people with profound and multiple learning disabilities, or people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities. And there were loads of films in, I think we did four conferences. There's probably 200 films in the conferences overall, and about 50 of them have just gone up on YouTube for anybody to watch. And there's some absolute corkers. They're
I
gorgeous.
started yesterday. It's quite funny actually, because one of my parents in my class sent it to me yesterday, not knowing that we were having this chat today, and said, "Do you know about Joanna? You should really watch this." I said, "Oh, it's funny you say that." I'm chatting with her tomorrow, but so I started. Yeah, I started on them. So, yeah, and they are so powerful.
Found Disability Netflix on there at the moment because there's so many of them. Yeah.
Absolutely, and it's such a great place to start. So, if anything, Joanna is saying tonight has kind of sparked your interest, or got you thinking about how you could be doing things better for your child, or at school, or wherever you work, they are a great place to start because it's all there, isn't it? Free access.
It was the first one, because I've been doing a PhD the past 3 years, and the first one was me stuck with something I was supposed to be writing for the doctorate, and just think I've been reading all these research papers, and I was just thinking it would be so much easier to talk to these people than to try and understand what they're saying. And then I went a bit kind of daydreamy in my head, and I thought, oh, I'll just ask people to talk to me. And I sent an email to, it was like off the top of my head, 40 people that I thought it would be really interesting to listen to if they were going to talk about disability. They would be more interesting to listen to than the research papers that I was reading. And I sent it as an email, but I didn't, because what I was supposed to be doing was doing that work, I didn't really register that I'd actually sent it. And then I got all these replies back going, yeah, I'd do that. Oh gosh. And then it kind of happened to me. And then I got too many videos to fill up the first conference. So then the second event happened. And then as that one was closing, people were like, well, when's the next one? And you're like, I haven't really planned to do any of this. Out of hand. They were marvellous. They were just, yeah, they were brilliant.
And it is so much better. Well, it's so much easier for me. That's how I process information. I'm learning so much from doing these lives rather than reading and watching. It feels so interactive, and I feel like, well, it's my private, like, free, ask questions. I like get to ask all these experts some questions. I'm learning so much. My practice has improved so much this year from being able to talk, just have a conversation.
That's the nice thing about the online world, isn't it? Like I've always used my Facebook photo albums as like archives for people, but things like there's lots of podcasts around now. I get interviewed on them. I'm not like organized enough to run one, but things like the Born at the Right Time, Skies We're Under podcast with regards to found disability is so much insight, and that you can get that you can have access to that for free. It's really good.
Yeah, and social media as a whole as well, you get all direct access and up-to-date access on all of these amazing updates and practices and interventions, and I feel like it's really pushing the affirmative agenda forward. I mean, God, you were doing affirmative practices decades ago, and I feel like only just everyone's kind of trying to catch up.
I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. You saw me present with Flo. So I was on the road with Flo for a couple of years, and Flo was my sensory engagement hero. And the first time I met her, I was co-presenting one of her events with her. And it's just, yeah, extraordinary what people have done before us. I think quite often people are landed in classrooms and they don't have the time to go out and find out about everything that's gone before. And certainly where I'm basing the work I do, like I base the training days that I run as the sensory projects on research. I said it's difficult going to read research, but it's so worth doing. Like there's so much good stuff in there. And I kind of view it as my job to read. I do a lot of long train journeys. So I sit on the train and I read it and I figure out what part of this would be useful to people. I quite often say to people at events, if I read a research paper that says they had a specialist bit of equipment that cost a couple of £1,000 and a quiet room and three members of staff, and they did, like, there's no point in telling anybody anything about that because it's not. But I go through it and I pick the bits that are going to be useful, and then I try and package them up in ways that are easier to digest than a research paper. And that's that go between role. There's so much support out there. And if people are in classrooms or care settings or at home in their house and they can find some of it, like you can send me a message on Facebook anytime, day or night, and there's people out there who will vouch for this. I will write back and probably on the train. I'd rather talk to you than read my research paper. And there's loads of people like me out there who will back you up and support you, because the structures and systems that we work within or that you have to fight against often do the opposite to that.
Yeah, and I feel like the people that are in this space and choose to be in this space are doing it because they genuinely want to make a difference. And you can only make a direct difference with people you actually can have access to, but actually that's not the case anymore. You can impact and influence and make changes with people that you will never meet. It's incredible.
Yeah. The online world gets a lot of stick, but it is a marvelous, it's a marvelous thing. I've done training in Singapore and India and Uganda through the little window of the online portal. So yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's incredible. So you were a special education teacher, is that right? Is that how you started?
My background in inclusion probably predates me, because my mum and my grandma both worked towards more inclusive society in their own way. And my mum's ambition was, she wanted to, my mum and dad met at university, and my dad's ambition was to build a boat and go sailing around the world. And my mum's ambition was to convert a double-decker bus so that it could carry people who use wheelchairs and take them on holiday to Italy. And I grew up on a boat that my parents built by hand, and I think I'm my mum's bus. Like, I think I'm what became of that ambition. She never got to return. But I've been a special school teacher, I've been a teaching assistant, I've worked in a variety of roles within education, from teaching assistant to inspector, looking at how to support children with additional learning needs access education. And then since the sensory projects, the youngest person I've worked with is a day old, and the oldest person were in their 80s, and I get to work in all sorts of different places now. Like, I do a lot of heritage settings. It's been wonderful because heritage places have all these gorgeous stories that they want to share with people, and I'm like, you could do it in a sensory,
some beautiful setting as well.
Somebody made me the smell of Georgian sweat at Hampton Court Palace for a sensory story once, like things you didn't think would happen. But I've also been a foster carer for children with complex disabilities, and I have my own children. So I have a neurodivergent child and a severely neurotypical child.
Yes, I love that. And I feel like that then when you're talking, you can relate to, and others can relate to you, because what you're saying is realistic. Like you were saying, well, quiet rooms and three adults, it isn't realistic. You know that because you've lived it.
Yeah, that's what I do. None of what I put out as training is based on anything I've done. I was a fairly all right teacher and I'm a fairly all right parent, but I wouldn't want anybody to base anything they did off stuff I did in my classroom or stuff I do with my children. I go through the research and I kind of filter it through my experience. So it's that experience that I'm using to judge, is this worth telling to other people? And so it's not a perfect filter, but that's what I'm bringing to it.
It's bite-sized and it's realistic. Yeah. What are you working on at the moment? What are your projects at the moment?
So for the past 3 years, I've been studying for a PhD in identity and belonging for people found intellectual and multiple disabilities. And the big thing that I've done there is work out a way of doing research with people with profound intellectual disabilities. And it's one of those things that at face value seems like it wouldn't be possible, because research is inherently an intellectual pursuit, and this is a demographic of people defined by their lack of intellectual capacity. But there's little moves and things you can do. And in 2 weeks' time, just over 2 weeks, I will sit my final Viva, which is like the big exam that you do at the end of the PhD, and it will be decided whether I have done it or not. But hopefully, I will pass that Viva, and then I'll be Dr. Joe. So that's what I have been working on. And until I've done that Viva, I must not work on anything else because it's quite a big deal sitting the Viva. But I am in my head, and it's funny that you started this by talking about me and Flo, because Flo used to run Flo's forums. I don't know if it was a Flo's forum that you saw us at or if it was one of the courses. We used to do courses together, but Flo used to run like maybe once or twice a year Flo's forum, and she would invite all sorts of different speakers. It's a bit like the PMLD conferences that I ran online, but it was in person. She would invite all these different people who knew stuff about this world or who were doing new things, or she'd just have everything. And it was fantastic what you'd learn from the people that she platformed. It was also the opportunity for all those people who were sitting as delegates in those rooms to meet each other and to meet people in other schools who did a job like theirs. And it's one of those things, quite often, especially if you work with the people with the most complex levels of disability, quite often you're isolated in your practice because you'll be like the only teacher in the school that does that, or you're the specialist support person who deals with that particular person. And so the chance to bring the community together was really, really valuable. And so I'm daydreaming about not Flo's forum, but Joe's forum. And it would be, I'd like to do one on voice, what voice means for people with complex disabilities, and bring insight from research in an accessible and friendly way, and all those lovely people who are doing good cool stuff. But I don't know how to do that. I don't know. The logistics of it is, I'm good at reading the research.
That's a problem for future.
I'll put that on her to-do list. I don't know how you book the venues, how do you do the catering, all of
This
that
is it,
sort
isn't it?
of
Because you can be really excited about your specialist subject or your interest, but then now you've got to market yourself and you've got to book venues and you've got to design posters. How do
I
you want to do that?
do
I just want to talk to all these people.
it small scale for the lectionary, and I run the super sensory lectionary every year at around about my birthday because it's my favorite thing to do, and I book venues for that, and I sort food for that, and hopefully everybody who's ever been on a Lex had dinner and was sat inside somewhere for it. But I remember booking a venue, I think it was in Bristol, and I do a thing. So I want to book ethical venues, so I've always booked places that like do something nice with your money rather than booking just your standard corporate hotel. So I end up in these weird improvised spaces, and like this particular venue, you hired the hall space, and then I think they ran a soup kitchen and an initiative for single parent. All of that was what was being funded by your hire fee. So I was like, great, definitely the venue I want. And it was marketed as an ethical venue, so it's like perfect. Didn't even have to Google for long. Got my venue, ordered the dinner, got there at 8 o'clock in the morning for a court for a conference that starts at 9 o'clock, and obviously I'm paying by the hour, and this is not a get rich quick strategy. This is a way to have a very happy and fulfilling life. But I'd only paid for 1 hour before my delegates arrived. I was like, I can set it up in an hour, it'll be fine. I got there and it was a nightclub. It was underground, it had no lights, no tables, no chairs, it got like sticky floors and a toilet in the corner. And I'm there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I've got 30 delegates arriving at 9 o'clock, and you're just like, oh my goodness. So maybe if I run a forum, I should just book a hotel.
Or visit Perth.
I ran into a cafe next door and begged chairs off them. I found fairy lights from my boxes of sensory resources, and by the time people arrived, it looked like a little sort of like a little underground cave, like a sort of
And
crinkly
people probably
place.
thought, oh, this is clever.
Was very on brand. It was all improvised, very sensory. The stickiness wasn't really needed, but
Oh, that's brilliant. But it happens, and you just got to go with it, haven't you? You've just got to roll with it. I feel like your time being a foster carer and a special education teacher probably prepared you really well for just off the cuff, just thinking on the spot.
Well, it's a nice thing. The people who come on the Lex are also like that as well. So they're totally willing. They're fast.
Actually, if they'd arrived at the time, they'd have probably helped you out and, you know.
People did, yes. Yeah, early delegates did help carry the chairs. Yeah. Set up. We found some planks somewhere. I don't know where we got the planks from, but they were our tables.
I love it. And why not? And actually, what a great icebreaker.
Oh, somebody in the chat was at the venue. Oh. I hope. There was one person who arrived and they came downstairs to the underground cave that I built for them, and they looked in and they went, my friend is claustrophobic, I'm not sure if they're going to be able to come in. We're like, open the door. They survived. It's one of the things I remember.
That's brilliant. I feel like I'm kind of following in your footsteps a little bit, because I've also been a foster carer and a special education teacher and a teaching assistant. I obviously need to start my own research. I'm really excited to see the impact of that, because actually the idea of belonging and being included in the research and having a voice within the research and tapping into that is incredibly needed. And I'm really excited to see actually what impact that has.
Yeah, I hope it will have some impact. It's definitely a thing. I'm doing it as a survival process rather than an achievement.
Yeah, but I mean, it's needed. It's really needed. Everything you do is really needed. It's why I wanted you on here.
I think it often, when you talk about research, it often seems like a very sort of dusty, you know, shelves of libraries, out of touch thing. And especially when you hear about research being done that does seem so fantastically out of touch, in my quiet room with the three members of staff type of stuff. But the risk of not being included in research or not having your voice heard in research is huge. Just from like a simple policy level, you think about the government officer who's just been put in charge of healthcare, or has just been put in charge of adult care, or has just been put in charge of education. What they do is they go, okay, we've got to decide what we're doing, what do we know about this, and they look for what we know as a nation, and what we know as a nation is what our research says. So they go and find the people that know stuff, and that's the researchers. Actually, they probably don't. They'll send some sort of 20-year-old university who can afford to work for a year, go and find out what we know about this. What do we know about teaching children to read? Go and find out. And that 20-year-old has to go and read all the research that's been done on teaching people to read, and then they write it up as a summary, and they come back to the minister, they go, this is what we know about teaching children to read.
Yeah.
And if people with profound disabilities aren't even there in the research, they won't be considered on the policy table. They don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, so just doing research that involves them counts in some way, because it gives them a presence in those spaces.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's lazy to assume that you can't, because there must be a way.
Yeah.
and that's what your research proves.
Yeah, there is, but you don't want to argue because it's too long.
Yeah. And I suppose classroom on ground in practice level, we could also be doing that, couldn't we? We can be including these people, these children that we care for, within EHCPs, within their IEPs, within their reports, within their meetings with parents. It takes more thinking about to find their voice and include them, but that's what we should absolutely be doing, for exactly the same reason that you're saying.
I feel like we should brainstorm what I do after the PhD, because you started with Flo's Forum, and then we looked back around to that, and then that's my thought for the first one. If I ran one, it would be about voice, because that's a subject that's looked at in research. And obviously people think of voice as being the sound that I'm making with my mouth, but within special education we also recognise voice in sign, in symbol, in like multiple other ways. But there are more extensions to that and more expansive ways of understanding voice, and quite often schools have got some sort of pressure on them to include pupil voice. So like I saw a write-up that said We have successfully included the children with profound intellectual disability in the student council. And me reading it, I was like, brilliant, great. How did you do that? Because I'm looking to include people with profound intellectual disability in research. How did you do it? Brilliant. And how they'd done it was those children had been wheeled to other classrooms where they picked up photos. Well, no, they hadn't picked them up. They'd been handed photos that had been taken by more intellectually able children, photos of things that were of concern to them. And then they wheeled the photos into the room. And you're like, and that's including them? That's just using them as a cart.
It's token. Yeah, exactly that.
Well, yeah. But the sort of the galling thing is, it was published because it is progressive. they tried. It was a step. Being like, oh, but there's a few more steps we could take, and there's different ways of listing him.
There are. So we are on the. We're not even on the first step. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, there are pockets.
Last Saturday, I went to a conference held by my local MP ahead of the new budget, going to London and all that kind of thing. That was last Saturday, and one of the things that the main person at county had said, Cornwall Council actually, had said was we have found the way to include people's voice. And parents next to me were like, fantastic, how are you doing this? Well, we're going to use symbols. And then they went, oh, well, my child doesn't use symbols, they can't access symbols. Oh, well, they're going to use sound buttons and my child can't do that, and whose voice would that be, and who's deciding what's on that sound button? You know, these parents had such great, I mean, parents are incredible, like they just are, they just know, and they were asking all these questions and she didn't have an answer. And actually what you were saying then just reminded me exactly of that. Is it's great, it's fantastic that you recognize that these people voices need to be on this document. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think they've worked out the how yet.
People doing that, that's great that they've figured that bit out. It's just different places in the journey, isn't it? And being able to find out about the next bit would be really good too.
Yeah, yeah. I always feel really awkward on the people voice section when I'm using first person. Actually, and yeah, sometimes, and well, often I choose not to use first person. I say an adult who knows them very well has observed that da da da, because actually we don't know actually how they are feeling, if they are happy in school, if they feel like they're thriving, if their mental health is good. We can make an assumption on what we see and what we know about them, but we don't necessarily know. And unless we work out ways that we can. And it's, I guess it's different for every individual as well. It's so individual, isn't it? How to access them.
There's a researcher that I really admire who's just doing a PhD looking at the practice in Frozen Light Sensory Studio. So Frozen Light are a sensory theatre company, and they've been collaborating with a team of people with profound multiple learning disabilities to create a new show. And this researcher has sat in on those collaborations and watched what's going on. And she published a paper recently, and she was talking about just that issue. And she said there is a risk of their voices being dubbed over by the voices of other people. And you think, yeah, even when you are the person who knows them the best, it's still going to be a little bit your voice coming through, isn't it? And what you would want is for it to be wholly their voice, and you're doing, like, you would give it as much as you possibly can, but that recognition that your voice is not their voice. It might be the best approximation that we've got, but it's not their voice.
Right.
It's worth it. And just the straight writing in person first language
isn't it?
You're not the only person who feels uncomfortable with that. But the point of doing it was to, it's a sad one, isn't it? But they have been so objectified that the point of doing it was to alert people to go, oh, actually this is a person who's got opinions and thinks things, right, and feels things. And so there was a reason for it in the first place. And one of the continuing journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to, everybody that works with in any capacity of, like, if it's care or school or home or whatever, we all need to have the aim of listening and sharing views and their voice as much as we can, but making sure that when we do it, we're asking ourselves why and for what benefit. Because it needs to be for their benefit. It needs to be because they want to, because they're benefiting, not to tick a box, not to jump through a hoop, not to, like, a bit like your school council example is perfect for that. Was that for that young person's benefit, or was it for the school's benefit, or for their website or their lovely photos or whatever? I mean, I can't answer that because I wasn't there, but I certainly see it in my own practice.
I was just
We have
thinking.
to constantly question, why are we including them in that? Why? And is it for the child's benefit?
Yeah. The listening in different ways. The research that I was just talking about, Johanna Rohr, she has an Instagram profile, and we're on Instagram, aren't we? Called Sensory SLI, I think. And she has been recording information. So when I did my research, I worked collaboratively with four young women who have profound and multiple learning disabilities. And after we worked together, I would write out my records of what happened, like a diary, write what we did. But Johanna hasn't been writing. She's been drawing what happens. And she draws in highlighter pen on post-it notes. And so she spends time with these people. And all the time, she's an artist. So her highlighter pen drawings are way beyond anything mine would be. She does these little post-it note drawings. And so the data that she has from her research, my data from my research is all these hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes that I then go back through and look at what happened and analyze in all sorts of different ways. Her data is thousands of tiny pictures on post-it notes, and her data analysis was gorgeous because, of course, she stuck them all over a wall, and then you move them around and you see patterns and you see themes. And I think anybody who's worked with people with profound and multiple learning disabilities, if you go and look at those pictures, and we'll share the link to her profile. I bet you see things in it that you know, and there's no words at all, but there is meaning there, and there is something communicated, and it resonates. And finding those different ways of communicating things and understanding meaning, because once you use language, you tend to think of meaning as being a language-based thing, but language is just one way of representing meaning. So when you sort of appreciate these other ways of representing meaning, then you can start. You end up. I was and my undergraduate degree was in philosophy, which I think accounts for a lot of these. But like, once you're thinking of other ways of apprehending meaning, you can ask, what is meaning to that person? Because meaning to me is a linear, connected, reasons, language-based thing. But what's their meaning? How do they experience their meaning? How do they express their meaning? And then what would that voice be? And you're off. You're off into a philosopher's paradise.
Yeah, and I
Maybe.
think asking that question, even without an answer, because that's philosophy, is it? Even that, just that we're asking ourselves that question constantly, I think is really good practice. Actually, is what does meaning look like for this child, or young person, or adult, or whatever? What does this meeting look like? What does the answer to this question look like for this child? It might not be an answer, but it's just asking yourself that, I think, is really good practice.
Absolutely.
Coming right back to the beginning, the sensory story. Are we
Oh,
just
yeah.
ticking the box saying we do lovely sensory stories, or is it actually, does this have meaning and purpose, and is it engaging for this person? Because if it isn't, what are we doing?
Sometimes I see sensory stories being done like a like an activity out of a box. You go, what was it? Last time I saw one, like a sensory story about autumn. So there's a load of leaves and there's bugs and there's mud and all great, good quality, good sensory stuff. And it's read out and then it's put away and then it's on to the next thing. And like, oh, you can get, it's not bad. That's nice. You played with some leaves and you've got some mud. It's lovely. But you can get so much more out of them. And when I do training about them, I do a day called Ambitious and Inclusive Sensory Storytelling. And I always presume that the people that I do that day to know what sensory story is already. I mean, if you don't, you would learn it by the end of the day. But the day isn't about how to write sensory two stories or how to tell, it's about how you get more out of them, because there are ways of telling them that just something like considering the processing time of people, that version of the sensory story that I'm sort of, I have got a particular event in mind, but I'm cobbling it together because I don't want to point a particular setting and say, oh, that was a naff sensory story. But if you've had a think about what the processing time of the different people in the room is, you might have somebody who, when you put the dried leaves in their hand, feels the dried leaves straight away, closes their fingers around them, hears the crackle as they close their fingers, gets all that information. And you might have somebody for whom, when the dried leaves go on their hand, those messages very slowly start to go to their brain. And by the time they've got like halfway up to their elbow, the dried leaves have gone on to the next person. And so they just sort of are very passive. And that's one of these things that you see, these people who are very passive. And there is research around the passivity of people with profound and multiple learning disabilities that shows that some of that passivity is physiological. Like if you can't move your arm, you're not going to be waving your arm around. But a lot of it is learned. And if the experiences that you were offered passed you by before you had the chance to have them, then of course you're going to be passive. So adding in questions about processing time can enrich how you tell the stories, and how often you repeat them and the ways in which you repeat them can enable two-way communication. It's all this like things you can tell the stories about, because obviously it's autumn, so we're doing the autumn sensory story, we're doing the Halloween sensory story, we'll do a Christmas sensory story. But actually there's so many more stories we could be telling, stories about particular people, events in their life, stories to give them access to new experiences. And there's all this way, like, I'm such a fan of sensory stories that you can just go into them and then go and do
first understanding of sensory stories, actually, that it was that it can give offer experiences or and support understanding of experiences or to help anticipate experiences that they haven't yet had access to. For example, I don't know, going on holiday on a plane, for example. Lots of my children, I don't think any of them, my children have ever been on a plane before. So we're doing all these lovely stories about vehicles and planes. It doesn't mean anything to them unless they've actually experienced it, practiced you feeling it, like feeling the vibration, hearing the sounds, you know, being tipped in or whatever it is, sit laying back on the chair. It gives them that experience so that if we're then talking about an aeroplane in future, or we do another topic about whatever, or they're about to go on a plane, then they've got something to base it on.
Yeah, you're totally. So the original sensory story project was just 5 sensory stories. And I said at the start, there's now over 30 published on the projects. Since 2020, I've been publishing stories by other authors. And my most recent sensory story by another author is by a Canadian special education teacher, and it's called The Family Party. And the purpose of that story is to support people in going to parties that they might be going to go to. And so it's all the opportunity to rehearse the things that might happen, to practice, to work out how you're going to cope with those experiences in order to build your capacity to access an actual party. And so, yeah, it's exactly what you say. And that thing about you might not have experienced it. I worked with somebody who worked. So it was one of these magic of social media things. Somebody was sending me messages backstage on Facebook. And I think the backstage of my Facebook is probably where I have the most impact in the world. And she just sent me messages saying, I work in this place and I've heard about sensory stories and could I tell a sensory story? And I was sending back, yeah, of course you can. And she's like, well, we don't have any. And I was like, you can make them up. And I'm sending lots of messages like that all the time. So I wasn't particularly paying, not that I wasn't paying attention, but yeah. I wasn't clocking into who she was and what was going on. And then she started to send me pictures. And she worked in an institution in a country where provision for people with disabilities is something that we would recognise 100 years ago. And these people in this institution, she'd done a sensory story about going to the beach and having your ice cream fall off the cone. And she said, and I realised none of them have left the building. They've not even been outside. And then she set about figuring out how to get ice creams. And so it was this gorgeous thing of like from the sensory story to the real experience. And later on in my pictures with her, there are photos of these complexly disabled people in the village square covered in ice cream. It's
Amazing.
fantastic stuff.
It shows how powerful it can be, right? Both sharing from on social media, but also by just giving it a go and actually asking these questions and trying it. So I suppose, I mean, as we're coming to an end, I kind of like to give myself a challenge after everything, just because I want to improve my practice. So I suppose coming from this conversation tomorrow, I'm going to be thinking a lot about the why. You know, why am I doing this? Who is it for? And actually, what? How can we? What's happening before the event? What's happening after the event? And just maybe giving it a little bit more time to land and to settle, and maybe just see where it goes, rather than having too much of a plan in my head. Right, that's over. Let's move on. Maybe just letting it just settle and kind of giving it an opportunity to see what happens, I suppose, is probably my challenge for this week.
If you wanted things around sensory stories, if people are doing sensory stories already, then I mean the you know, do an audit. Are your sensory is your sensory stuff a really good sensory invite? Is it interesting to the senses, or is it reliant on intellectual curiosity? Is your text concise? What's your capacity to allow for different processing times, and how could you set up that group situation so that you could allow for those different times? So, like if you're doing a big group, could you do it in small groups and rotate around? Do you have to do it in the big group? What about thinking about developmentally relevant sensory experiences? So, picking the stuff that I can access at the level of capacity that I have of my senses. What about telling sensory stories about other things? Like I talk about how the stories that we hear when we're little about who we were. Like I said, I grew up on a boat, and I always tell people I grew up on a boat because it's one of my favorite stories to tell about myself. But I've been told stories about who I was on the boat, and those little stories that about 2-year-old me, that who I don't remember the experiences, but those stories that I've been told are part of my understanding of who I am. If I've got an intellectual disability, if I haven't got access to those stories in that way, can you tell me stories that tell me who I am? Can you tell me those stories in a sense?
Joanna, thank you so much.
Sure.
I've left more inspired than I even was 13 years ago when I saw you last time. I hope to see you in person again. And
Absolutely.
I'm really excited to hear about the impact from your research, because I think it's going to be really exciting. Thank you so much, Joanna, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Thanks all. Bye.